January 13th, 2013 edition of Warrior Connection. And respect is what you always get, and that's what everybody needs if served in the U.S. military, and we need respect to ensure that everybody in our country understands what we've done, make sure that we get all the medical care and all the environmental cleanup needs to be done. Well, again, we're heading into another anniversary here. Boy, it's incredible to think about it, but quite a few years ago, 1991, that right now we were sitting in Riyadh, and I was sitting at the command headquarters, and we were preparing for launching the air war and Operation Desert Storm. As we started to prepare for everything, everybody was frightened and terrified, to say the least, because we knew Iraq absolutely had the chemical and biological warfare munitions that the U.S. Army provided to them. We knew they had Scuds. We knew that they had artillery, army, mines, landmines all set up all over the place. And so, again, coming down to talking about history. We're going to continue this week as we started last week with anybody calling in to join us to talk about what they know, the history, how it all got set up, what happened, what the consequences are, and where we need to go from here. Denise, are you with us tonight?
I certainly am. Just waiting for the call-ins. I've put out the call on Facebook for people to call in, and we want to talk about the history and what's happened to us since and what we need to do to get our vets taken care of.
Yeah, and again, the phone number to call in, and when you call in, just call in and the producer will get you in. Just pipe right up when you call in. Let us know you're there. Is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. Well, you know, we got over there. Our unit got over there, and we started setting up the command staff right in the first week of December of 1990. We had already been working on the command staff operations and preparations for battle going back to late spring of 1990, and again teaching all this stuff beginning probably late July through November. Throughout this whole part, we were actually involved in teaching, making sure everybody was ready until the command staff deployed there the end of November, beginning of December. So anyhow, we got over there, and then obviously the main thing we were going to start into, as everybody knows, the air war was scheduled to start on the night of January 15th and 16th. And it did. In order to have the air wall set up, what we had is obviously we had the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Army in place, and the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy had the aircraft carrier Saratoga, Kennedy, Theodore Roosevelt, and America in the Red Sea. Again, that's over along between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And then what we had is the aircraft carriers Midway and the Ranger. They were both stationed in the Persian Gulf, and then backed up by the battleships Wisconsin and Missouri. The Air Force units, the primary Air Force unit, was down south of Riyadh, south of Eskan Village at the Air Force base there. That's where the jets and everything were coming in from. Denise, the medevac units, where did you guys start to station and put everything together from?
Okay, I think most of us came in through King Khalil Military City, or King Fahd. Take it back. We landed at Eskan, you know, outside the air base there, which was Riyadh.
Riyadh. And you came in the middle of a Scud attack.
Yeah, we did. The first Scuds that went into Israel, and then the Scuds that were coming into KKMC. We were right in the middle of that when we got off the plane. So we spent, I think it was 9 days there, 8 or 9 days, and then we moved forward to KKMC. And then we moved forward after, I think, about 7-8 days there. We moved forward to our forward location, which was Log Base Charlie, which was between Haffa al-Batin.
Al-Batin. You were up to the north. You're in the northwest corner on the tap line.
Yeah, between there and Rafa, which I think was the furthest that the American forces went. But we were right there on Tapline Road, which we turned into a landing strip. You know, had to put our tents up. We got there, and there was one little hexagon tent for the log base there, which was Logistics Army in there. A little bitty small hexagon. And so next thing we knew, there was Sealand trailers put at each end of the Tapline Road, and blocked off that area and used that as the runway this, you know, landing strip. And then we had a detour road that I guess the Army engineers kind of built around it for regular traffic. So we were up there receiving patients from three Army hospitals. So we had patients that were Americans, and we had enemy prisoner of war. Our duty was to receive them, to be sure that they were ready for air vac, which we needed to check their vital signs, any chest tubes, any wounds, be sure that they were stable. Lab work had been checked, you know, to be sure they had sufficient red blood cells to go to altitude. And what the Air Force did is they operated the 130s. The 130s came in with supplies, logistics supplies, offloaded. We got on the plane, configured the plane for air vac, which is putting the stanchion poles in place, bringing the straps down, and our equipment and the litters, the litter. So, gosh, I don't even remember how many missions we ran, but we got them from three Army hospitals, had to check their records, be sure their records were there with them. They were usually stuffed at the bottom of their litter, and we would, you know, evaluate them. You know, the plane would come, and the plane, if they had supplies offloaded, we used the backward capabilities of the plane, being backward, being retro haul. And all of our patients went into KKMC, at which time MedBase America there was a hub between the strategic and the tactical and the strategic. They had, I think, three tents when we got back there, and we saw more of the setup when we moved retrograde after the ceasefire and all. And they had three tents there. One was for those that would be, you know, sent somewhere in theater to Army hospitals there at KKMC, or, you know, to Riyadh even. The majority of them were being switched over to 141 aircraft to go to Germany. And from Germany, then they were air-vac'd back into the States.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was a lot of stuff, I know, because on the setup for all the medical evacuation, whether both ground and air, that was put together by the 92nd Medical Battalion out of Springfield, Illinois. And as you know, a member of our team, obviously Sergeant First Class Rollo Dolph, was the NBC and medical guy in charge of it. Mm-hmm. But the first member of our team to die from lung cancer was Sergeant First Class John Sitton, who had put all that medical evacuation program together. I don't know if you remember when you guys...
The thing of it is, I was looking up a list to provide to somebody else online, but the list from the Comacia exposures. And what I noticed when they first put it out, and ever since, it hasn't changed, but it had all the Army units on the Comacia exposures that they listed. They forgot any Air Force units, and it was not just the mobile staging facilities that were all along the border. We had them all the way, you know, to Kuwait side. Echo, Log Base Echo, Charlie, all of them had a mobile aeromedical staging facility. About 40 of our unit personnel, which was from Kelly Air Force Base, 32nd AG, the 37th from Florida was also there with their masses. So each of those were about 40 personnel. And then what happened when we got in theater is the squadrons and flights that were below us as far as size and what they did came in, and we divided personnel to go with us for, you know, we have to have the people that maintain the mobile staging facility, and then we have to be able to generate nurses and med techs to go on board and fly the mission.
Yeah, I remember doing that. We were putting that all together right there at Riyadh at the airfield in the terminal. So from 3rd MedCom, we came over there and we started meeting all you guys, giving your fast briefings.
And then we had the liaison teams, which would be the Medical Service Corps officer and two radio operators that were with the Army. So, you know, we had people scattered out. The squadrons and flights got divided up. You know, we'd get a flight from each of them to take with us in case we needed to generate a crew from the log base versus a crew coming on board from KKMC or wherever.
Your unit primarily supported both the 82nd and 101st, correct?
7th Corps. We mainly supported 7th Corps.
Yeah, they were.
So that was that area on the map, on the war plans. And so we had people back at CENTCOM that sat there with CENTCOM coordinating the flights, which was, again, medical service officer and radio operators, and usually one and two radio operator for around the clock. And the thing I found interesting, even though that I've been involved since the early get-go with the Osagui team and all, I kept speaking up for my group. I had pulled out the old orders of who was attached and where they went, and tried to get them to include the air vacs, much less the combat control teams that were forward into Iraq. And then there was, I'm trying to remember the terminology, but when you're hauling patients, there is a definite, you know, requirement when you have any kind of forward airfield, you got to have the fire truck. So we had the fire truck and that crew. None of them were listed or identified. What they put at the bottom of the list is Air Force crews that were scattered all throughout at KKMC. They don't list it by units, you know, attached units or anything. And so our Air Force personnel, what I'm getting to, even when we talk about the bunkers being exploded, Kamasia, you know, I don't think they ever got letters like the Army did.
I know. I mean, I got a personal letter sent to me by Bernie Rogers saying, "Dear Doug,"
yeah.
And it was real funny since we had put out the original warning. So Bernie sent me a letter saying, "Dear Doug, you got exposed when our team had put out the warning saying everybody was being exposed."
So, you know, even when Osagui was doing all their stuff, the Presidential Oversight Board, the Presidential Advisory Committee, I kept going and turning in this list and going, go to the archives, pull out the data. But this is the list I have. It didn't cover everybody because we had units all along the border. We had one that remained back at KKMC, which was supposed to be the jump forward to, I can't remember the jump forward location, but there was an ASF on hold, a mobile staging unit to jump forward, which never happened. So they stayed at KKMC where the rest of us went forward.
Yeah, I think when we look at the array of troops there, obviously the main staging areas were down Dammam and Dahran and then Riyadh, and then from there we went up to KKMC. But when we looked at the array of forces, obviously coming from the Persian Gulf in the east, coming back to the west, we had the Saudi Arabian troops. They were right along the Kuwaiti-Saudi border. Backing up them along the coast were the U.S. Marines, and again, we've got a lot of Marines involved, and hopefully they'll call in tonight.
And I know we had a French contingent down the road somewhere because they found us and came visiting.
Yeah, and then right behind the Saudi and next to the Marines, we had the U.S. Army. Again, this is 18th, and then behind them was Britain. Along the U.S. Army, along right off Rabatan was France. Then we had Egyptian and Syria, and then we had all of you guys from the 7th Corps arrayed all the way up the tap line.
Right.
So, I mean, quite an array of troops.
I'm going to put a call out right now. Any Air Force higher-ups that were at CENTCOM need to coordinate with whatever staffing is left at Osagui and bring up the people that were exposed just to the bunkers. And get them listed correctly, finally, after 20-something years. Shouldn't be that hard to do. Not as many as Army, for sure, but I do think that still needs to be corrected. So any Air Force higher ranking that knew where your units were forward and into Iraq, and including the combat control teams that, you know, were usually two or three guys usually directing whatever they were needed with the Army, co-locating them, because none of those people that I've talked to have ever gotten a letter on the exposure.
Hello.
Hi. Who have we got tonight?
Hey, my name's Rick.
Well, welcome, Rick. Thank you for calling in.
You're welcome.
Where you were located, Rick?
I'm sorry, you...
What unit were you with over in the Gulf?
Oh, I was with the 27th Engineer Battalion out of Fort Bragg. Combat Airborne, the we supported, I guess, the 6th Light Infantry French, and, you know, I don't even know a lot of, I've been trying to find maps of where we were, and it seems like we were in the middle of the desert the whole 7 months we were there.
You don't remember where you were? I know there was a...
They were going straight, just straight north, just to the west of Hafr al-Batan.
Yeah. I know there was an engineer command area down the road from us, past Coscom on the Time Road.
What were your experiences, Rick, and what did you see, what happened, and everything else? Please fill us in. When did you get there and all the stuff?
I got there September 14th, I believe. I left April 14th. When we first got there, we set up near Riyadh, I believe. We seemed like every couple of months we just kept moving forward. And, well, like I say, I don't even know where we moved to, but I know that we're over on the western flank, and I don't know, when we'd watch the rockets go off. I don't even know what those things were called. They would fire them off, blow up whatever the heck they were firing them at. We'd follow in behind those things after the, you know, the fellas made sure it was secure. And our mission was Az Zaman Airfield.
Yeah, sounds about right. And did you have people that got sick while they were there?
I'm sorry?
Did you have people around you that got sick while you were in theater?
You know, when you speak, it's like my volume's down, but when the other fellow speaks, it's pretty normal.
Well, what I was asking is, did you have any of them that got sick while they were in theater?
We lost 7 guys at the airfield. They were, what are they doing? They were disposing of exploded munitions or whatever. I don't know. They were disposing of explosives, disposing of them, what have you. They were doing it wrong or something. A lot of folks have heard about it. We lost 7 guys. One of them went off. They handled them wrong or something. But, you know, as far as gases and sarin and mustard and what have you, I believe that was every... That place is riddled with it, if you ask me. It's in every grain of sand, and it's...
Did you have, can you hear me
there.
Better now?
I'm sorry?
Okay, did you have your alarms set up as you moved forward?
I don't know if we even had an alarm set up. We never went into MOP gear. Our last base camp while we were still in Saudi, before the ground war started, I can remember being out on guard duty at nighttime and watching the flashes from the air raids, you know, the bombing.
Right.
It would light up the sky like lightning. I could feel it, the ground shake. You know, I don't know what the heck they were hitting, but they were pretty close to us. And, what the heck were they blowing up? Who knows?
Did you take pyridoxine bromide in preparation for... moving forward, PB tablets, white tablets?
I believe so, yes. My memory is pretty crummy about it, and I just love reading and then all about other people's experiences because it kind of jogs my memory, and listening to you fellas. And, I can remember still at Fort Bragg when they put you off into isolation and what have you before you get on the bird and head over. We walked through a gauntlet of needles. They were on each side of us. I was getting them left arm, right arm. I must have got 7 to 10 shots. And I think on my shot record, they got about 2 or 3. I don't understand that, you know?
Well, there was a direct order as we gave all the immunizations, because you have to understand that the botulinum toxin, again, this is the Regal Commission report, Iraq was given that, again, by the United States. They were given them the weaponized anthrax, again, by the United States out of Fort Detrick, Maryland. And so the necessity for the immunizations, you had the botulinum toxin, the anthrax vaccine, you had the GG gamma goblin, had all of the other stuff, smallpox, definitely because smallpox was known to be weaponized over there also. And then you had all the yellow fever, typhoid, tetanus, everything imaginable on the shot. I know what happened with our unit is when we did get the array of shots, we all got sick even before we deployed, and we got sick again in theater once we started administering the anthrax vaccine to everybody. Did you have a similar experience?
Not a bad sickness, nothing that would, that hindered me. I think as soon as I stepped off the airplane, I never felt right since. I don't know if it was just the climate, the lack of sleep, probably a lot to do with the shots and the pills, but I haven't been right since I stepped off of that airplane. And like other folks say, it's hard to explain. I don't know what to tell. I don't even talk about it to folks that weren't even over there. I barely even talk to anybody that's been over there about it because I don't know how to. Anyway, as far as getting sick while over there, I'm sure I was, but nothing that made me bedridden and couldn't work. But like everyone else, you don't let anything slow you down. You do your job and you army through it. And
let me ask you, did you get letters from the Office of Special Investigation or DOD about exposure? You did not get a letter?
Not at all, no.
Have you been in touch with others in your unit?
No, I have not. I haven't. I spent 20 years. I got in the Army in '92, May of '92, and it was 20 years before I even went to the VA regarding my health.
What promoted you to go to the VA for your health? What led you to do that?
I was worried about just how I didn't have any health insurance that entire time, and. I was getting, it was just going downhill. I was getting worse and worse, and I started worrying about, sooner or later, I've got to get some kind of insurance. I got to see doctors and catch this. I've got children and all that. I got to be responsible,
What type of physiological problems are you experiencing now, psychological or physiological?
I don't know either or, but I know my joints are messed up. I like everybody else's, they're cracking, they're popping, they're stiff. My muscles are sore. I got no memory. I got the IBS. I mean, there's an array of things that it comes and goes. Some things, what I never did get though was the skin rash. Not that I know, I'm not like some pictures I've seen.
Yeah, mine has flared up with the weather changes here. Mine's been horrible the last few days again.
Rick, have you had vision problems or dental problems?
I've got dental problems, but then it's a lack of seeing a dentist on my part. But I've been an alcoholic since the Army. I quit a year and a half ago for good, cold. But I spent 20, 25 years in a bottle, kind of punishing myself. I don't know, just not giving a darn. I had no feelings, no care about anything, no joy. Nothing brings me joy. Just depression, I guess. And
Rick, how have you said you went to the VA? How have you done with the VA, or what have? How were you greeted at the VA, and what have they done for you?
I was greeted with smiles, just the routine, polite smiles. But as far as I asked them if they ever heard of the Gulf War illness or anything like that, and they acted ignorant, like They just heard about it when I mentioned it, you know, and it made me feel kind of silly. They don't take it into account at all. Now they do try to treat me, you know. I've been had MRIs done and, I don't know, x-rays and things like that, and I don't know, just pills. They throw pills at me, and I'm just a number, you know, like everyone else is. You know, they're probably just so busy, and they don't know who to believe, who's telling a story. They have to be a little bit suspicious, you know, and I'm a little too, you know, I try to see both sides of the story, I try to see everybody's point of view, and I can, but it's not a personal experience. It's not a, like, they really care, you know. It's just a job, 9 to 5, I think, and...
Have you had help putting a claim in?
Yes, we've got a representative in town. It's run through the VFW, I suppose. It's who, when I signed the paper, just, you know, to let them handle my claim, it says VFW on the bottom. I just went to the county veteran affairs office, and I really didn't know what the heck I was doing. I didn't consult anybody before I did it.
Where do you live, Rick?
I'm in Michigan, near Detroit. I go to the Detroit VA Center. But what I did when I first went to the Veterans Affairs, I asked her, because I had read about the Gulf War Registry exam, and I thought, well, let me take this exam. Maybe they'll give me a good, thorough physical, check me all out, and find out why, you know, I'm feeling the way I feel. And her answer, I says, can I take the Gulf War Registry exam? She says, so you want to file a claim? I said, no, I just want to, you know, get checked out and see if my health is going to be okay. Okay, let's file a claim. I'll get the paperwork going. You come down and sign it. I mean, it was just like, screw your health. Let's get you some compensation. I mean, I wouldn't have filed a claim but the representative took the wheel and she filed the claim for me. And lo and behold, as far as I know, 6 to 8 months later, I was granted, you know, what do you call it, disability.
Did you, at the time you came back or since then, have you completed the post-deployment health assessment form, a Department of Defense Form 2796? Have you ever seen that or done that?
Never heard of it. I've done very little to look after my health. My first doctors, I went from 92 when they examined me to get out of the Army until October of 2011 without ever seeing any sort of medical, nobody, no doctor, nothing. I spent 20 years just trying to be a tough guy and suck it up, you know.
Well, you're not alone.
That's real common. That's for real common for all of us who have been in the military for any time. And again, that's part of the military psyche, to where you try to suck it up until such point as you crash and burn. And what we have seen, Denise, I think you saw this immediately. The individuals are coming in trying to be John Wayne Rambo altogether, and then you had a problem right off the bat.
Exactly, and I think that's part of the reason the VA is suspicious or not is.
We have to understand when we look at this stuff, and I'm looking at just on your own, I'm looking at the post-deployment health assessment form personally right now, and if you'll email either Denise or I, we'll make sure that you get a copy of this to take to your doctor. And you can email me at dlind49@aol.com, and then Denise is just dsnurse1@yahoo.com. But
all right.
Health problems, again, these are things on the health deployment physical assessment form, which is, you know, you need to update this all the time. Chronic cough, runny nose, fever, weakness, headaches, swollen, stiff, and painful joints. You've all already said that. Back pain, muscle aches, numbness or tingling in the hands or feet, skin diseases or rashes, redness of the eyes with tearing, dimming of the vision like the lights are going out, chest pain or pressure, dizziness, fainting, lightheadedness, difficulty breathing, feeling tired even after you're sleeping, difficulty remembering your memory, you've already indicated that, the diarrhea, you've already indicated that, frequent indigestion, vomiting, and ringing in the ears. these are the primary symptoms. Again, dealing with all the complex toxic exposures and effects just for the physiological systems that are known on the forms.
Everything you just mentioned there, be minus three, maybe two or three, is, you know, I can, that's me.
The other thing that we have known with the known exposures that cause the problems, again, this is right off the form, DEET insect repellent applied to the skin, the permethrin, this is the pesticide-treated uniforms, environmental pesticides, again, that's a nightmare, flea and tick collars, pesticide strips, all the oil well fire smoke. I mean, where you were, you definitely got zapped by that. Smoke from burning of trash or feces. And again, on that, President Obama signed a law on Thursday mandating for the burn pits a new VA registry and medical care. So that's a nice thing for us. Vehicle or truck exhaust fumes, tent heater smoke, JPA and other fuels, all the fog oils, all the solvents, all the paints, ionizing radiation. Again, this is depleted uranium and all the radioactive materials and all the equipment. Then we go to the radar and the microwaves, again, non-ionizing radiation, all the lasers, all the noise, excessive vibration, all the industrial pollution that was all over, the sand and the dust, and that, again, goes back to L-Escan disease, which God bless our angel, Colonel Andres Carnegie Bob, doctor, had figured out from day one, depleted uranium and all the exposures. These are the known exposures for which physiological effects are confirmed from Desert Storm and the current war. So, again, if you got zapped by all that stuff, that goes to explain why you've got these medical problems that we've already enumerated.
There you go. It's, you know, it's so frustrating that they don't just go ahead and admit it. I mean, yeah, it's obvious you guys were messed up with that. Let's, we're sorry. Let's try and get to the bottom of it. Let's try to cure you. I mean, you can't go to a war and not expect things like that to be around, to be exposed. You're a soldier, you deal with it. You gotta get the mission done, the task at hand, you do it. I mean, you can't eliminate those sort of things, and I don't, like, blame, you know, anybody for these things. That's just part of life. It's going to happen. It's just don't deny it and don't ignore it. I mean, you'd say, yeah, I mean, this is what I'd like to say to the VA or the government, whoever. You know, nobody forced twisted my arm to sign up. I'd gladly do it again, and I'd go through the same thing I went through. It, you know, that's just the way we are. But what's frustrating is they, you know, they make me feel like a fool or like a some kind of looking for a handout or something. You know, I want to, you know, just look into it and see what you can do to help these things up. I mean, quality of life is awful. It's, you know, I don't know.
You know, we're seeing from Operation Desert Storm, we had less than 1,000 actual casualties, wounded in action and killed in action and accidents. And again, majority were friendly fire during Desert Storm proper. Yeah. The latest data and information we have out of the 600-some thousand, there's over 300,000 now that have applied for permanent disability with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs that served in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, so we're at approaching 60%. And what is really horrific in finding, we're seeing the same 50 to 60% percentages now with similar, almost identical medical problems. Again, Denise, you've done a lot of work in the epidemiology for OIF and OEF and OND, and this is frightening.
Yeah. That, I agree. How many fellows, I mean, this has been going on for 10 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, we're looking at over a million now from OIF, OEF, with the same medical problems at 300,000 from Desert Storm.
Rick, I think you expressed it very well, saying, hey, we're not really looking for a handout. We want answers. We want acknowledgement that this is real, physiological, not psychological, although some have problems psychological, too. You know, you can have both. But, you know, to just treat us right and not act stupid to our troops that serve bravely and put our life on the line. And, yes, all of us would do it again, maybe with some forethought now. But you know, we're just asking for the right things to be done of look at us, really look at us. You know, I made a comment today on the biorepository we have for, and we fought to get this for over 10 years, so the brains, and if you die, you know, if you want to, you can donate your brain for study like the National Football League is doing. To look at damage that cannot be seen when you're alive, but they can dissect it and look at it afterwards. But the one thing that I've said is that's fine. We pushed for that for over 10 years. We've lost a lot of people that have died that we could have had a tremendous resource already there. But
you know,
they
when
didn't
we
do
did
it.
The when we did had the autopsies done again on Captain Terry Reardon with his wife Sue Reardon's permission, they found all of the problems in that autopsy, and that was one of the first military autopsies done on a known death with known exposures, and it was horrific what they found in that autopsy.
And we've been pushing for that, but the other part of that, that civilian chronic fatigue sufferers have been working on themselves for probably 8-9 years, is to have a repository for those that are living to have the blood, the urine, hair samples, punch samples of the skin, so that anybody that is researching this has a place to go to get all that without having to, you know, put out a thing on clinical trials to say, we're doing punch biopsies down in Georgia. If you want to get in, contact this person. Let's have a repository with that stuff there. I mean, we had something like that when we were active duty, that we were supposed to have blood saved in a repository, you know, and matching for DNA if you were a POW and came back dead, that they could match up. This isn't that hard to do, and my feeling is that's fine. I have pushed for that since God only knows when, and Kurt Love, a lot of us have been involved all along, pushed for that to be done. Way before NFL football decided to do, you know, stuff and look at concussions and football damage to the brain. But there is other things that can be done for the ones that are living, to find answers, to find the biomarkers, to have a repository where researchers can go and have access to a large number with it all coded. With your location in theater. That's one of the things that I've pushed for with researchers, is you've got to have the unit they served with, what their job was, so that we can kind of correlate with what exposures they may have had, jet fuels, what have you, but also the locations they went to in theater, so that, you know, you can classify it on a map of this is what you're finding in this unit and where they were. And you know, we're going to have to all speak up and say that's what we want done, you know, and push the system.
Well, there you go. That's such a great idea. I mean, common sense is just, you're looking for a cure. You're looking for preventative measures. How many soldiers, troops, women and men are already suffering from this, you know, the latest three wars here, and how many numbers are there going to be that, and they're not prepared for that? We're going to be overwhelmed more than we are now. And
the VA is already overwhelmed. I got appointed a new physician last week, and my doctor said, well, you're number 1301. I got 15 minutes for you, and I don't want to hear anything about your exposures because it doesn't matter, and I'm not going to look at it anyhow.
And in the early beginning, Rick, just so you know, in the early beginning, in the early 90s, we had specialty clinics in each of the VA hospitals for the Gulf War vets, and not in each, but there was like 10 or 13 nationwide, 10 to 12, I think it was. But, you know, you could get referred to those centers, and there was some commonality being seen. And then they did away with that by around 95, 96. So, you know, we had something going that we'd like to have back, which would be, you know, the specialty places, you know, geographically, so that, you know, you come in and they know something. Well, we did get the war-related illness centers, and if you haven't been to that, I know you probably found out about the program from Facebook, but
yeah.
if you go into VA.gov and put war-related illness, the WRIIF, you know, it'll lead you to the VA page and push your primary to put in for a consult. It can be done computer right there as you're sitting with them. But you kind of have to sit on top of them. And there's three of those now, New Jersey, Orange, New Jersey, D.C., and Palo Alto. And people that have gotten through that have been helped to some degree.
Yeah, on the War Injuries Clinic, you're in Michigan, you said. The person
yes.
of contact, again, for this area is Brenda Jasper. And her
yes,
phone
sir.
Number is 1-800-722-8340. This, again, is at the Washington, D.C. War Injuries Clinic. It's the number one clinic. They all go to there. Brenda Jasper at 1-800-722-8340. And you can call her direct, Rick, and then get your doctors to help coordinate everything together, and she can help you. Both Denise and I have been through their program up there.
Well, I'll take that back. Doug, I went out for Dr. Lee's research project.
Okay.
So I didn't go through their whole program. Dr. Lee grabbed me, knew I was going through the different research, because my feeling is that I get to know these researchers, and I don't push every research project, guys, and it's only been from 06, and knowing the researchers that are independent civilians that have gotten funded and having met them and really getting to know what they're looking at and how strongly they feel about wanting to help the Gulf War vets. So I do like some of them. I don't like every one of them. But I will say, if I am pushing to go to a research, that should be a clue. If I'm going to put my body out there and say, yeah, take it from me, take it from others. You know, it's kind of like a leader doesn't, you know, just tell you to go do something. They put themselves up there, too.
Denise, so, you're one of the authorities. You're one of the ones I look to. you've done so much. I mean, how busy you are, I don't know how you do it. But, I mean, if it comes from you, then I don't question it. So I trust your research and everything
well,
you do.
You know,
so,
I've heard
Thank
a lot
you.
Of discussion on Facebook, and people say I sent their own research. Well, I want to get us answers. I want to get us proper diagnostic techniques used, proper testing, and treatment in the end. I don't know if there's a cure, but, you know, be aware of us, know. Track if we have cancers, let's get the data. And, you know, I'm always pushing for things that I feel are important for the whole group, and that comes from the old nurse. But I watched them through the VA research and the DOD before we had the congressionally directed medical program get started in 06, actually. I was not impressed with what we were getting out of VA or DOD. There's only one VA program that I got involved with that was Dr. Ron Bach that was looking at our blood and our hypercoagulation, which is thick blood clots. And I'm amazed. I haven't told the story, and I'm hoping somebody eventually call into one of our programs. But I found one of our vets that is a miracle he's alive, and it's because he was an EMT. And he threw a blood clot, pulmonary blood clot, to a very critical area. And it's a miracle he's alive. And he got to the hospital, got treated at a civilian hospital because he works and lives and, you know, does everything around fellow EMTs, and they knew he was in trouble. And that has been my concern is with the thick blood. And that was the one researcher that as I sat at meetings and looked through the list of what VA was funding, I went all through this list and I'm going, this is garbage, you know, like having a red pen and going, nope, that's not what we need. You know, the one that, you know, I had been involved with a sample study that we got published back in 2000 with a civilian researcher out of Arizona. And to me, it's a life-saving test to have it tested, to know that you have some problems hypercoagulating and that this could affect your body, and there's treatment. It may not be the whole picture, but it's one little part. I wanted to ask, Rick, I'm not ignoring you, but I wanted to be sure if we've had anybody else call in.
No, yeah, go right ahead.
Has anybody else called in besides Rick?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you give us a first name and which unit you were with?
My first name is Scott. I was with the 24th Infantry Division. We were up in a neutral zone before we went into the ground war. There was the night that all the chemical detectors went off, January 18th, 19th time frame.
Right.
I can remember sleeping on the trim pane of the Bradley. We heard the explosion, and then the chemical detections went off right after. And, of course, we were already in MOP 3 because of being front line, which was useless because the NBC suits that we were wearing, we wore throughout the whole thing. So then, you know, of course, we went to MOP 4. About a few hours goes by, they come out, and they say it was a sonic boom. I was young and naive then, and, you know, it's what we believed. One of our objectives was Operation Gold, which was Comacia. So I've actually had my boots at Comacia. And I have received two letters from the CIA and the Department of Defense saying that I was exposed to sarin nerve agent gas. And then, of course, with the new evidence that Dr. Haley just came out with and James Tewitt, it sounds like we was exposed to even more than what I thought.
Okay. When you were there, did members of your unit get sick? Did you notice any memory problems, any irritability, any change in their functioning?
Not at first. Not because we got in theater in August. We left in the end of March. So once we got back to Fort Stewart, you know, that's when some of the more of the symptoms were showing up heavier, like the exploding diarrhea, stomach cramps, you know. We were pretty fit when we come back. And a lot of us couldn't even finish a 5K road march. Let alone, you know, PT and stuff. You know, it was just obvious that we were not the same. Then I came back and I was in a reserve unit. And, the physical condition of some of our reserve units back in that time wasn't the greatest. So I go to the reserve unit after I got out of the service. And I was dropping out on a simple road march around five blocks. It was pretty bad. My symptoms was more the diarrhea and the stomach at first. Then over time, it just gradually got worse. So it seemed like the older I became, the worse it got. I had a private insurance, so I'd go to my doctors, and by the time, you know, hey, I got these letters from the government saying I was exposed to sarin nerve agent gas, you know, not be part of my problems. Of course, you know, they just in one ear and out the other. They didn't even want to hear it.
Did you go on the highway of death?
What's that?
With the 24th, were you on the highway of death at all?
Yeah, we were, yeah. Yes. Can you still hear me?
The highway of death, for those who don't know, is where the 24th went in McCaffrey and he shot everything up. The fleeing Iraqis with depleted uranium all over the place. The A-10s came in, shot it all up. They shot it up with the M-60s and 105s and 120s, 105 millimeters depleted uranium, and the highway of death to this day is still thoroughly highly contaminated and requires total isolation. So, again, with that and the 24th and everything, you know, did you develop respiratory problems and neuromuscular problems or eye problems?
Neuromuscular. Skin rashes are rare, don't happen very often for me. Mine seems to be more neurological. I've been to the War-Related Illness Center out in New Jersey. in Pittsburgh where they did MRIs and all kinds of tests for 5 days or so. Of course, when I was at the War-Related Illness Center, they did diagnose me as Gulf War illness. I am 100% unworkable as far as my VA claim. When I first started going to the VA doctors, the first one I went to, he just didn't want to care. He didn't want to acknowledge that that was part of the problem. And so I educated myself on the Internet about the situation. And then the second doctor I saw didn't only see me, but they saw a binder about 2 inches thick. And I did not leave that office until they read it, or I made sure that they knew what was going on. And then from that point forward, their attitudes were a little different. It still wasn't a total cooperation on their part, but once I came back from the War-Related Illness Center, the doctor said this changes everything. So, you know, it's frustrating that still they don't want to admit that they affected us like they did.
Which VA are you going to?
Altoona.
Okay.
And
that's in Michigan.
Now they seem pretty decent to me.
That's in Michigan,
you know,
right?
they're working with me. They are trying different medications to try to help me. So it was like once they got that notification from the War-Related Illness Center, you know, their attitude was different. But the main thing here is, and this goes through the expiration date in 2016.
Right.
I had symptoms all along, and they got worse. Well, then I started getting in my late 30s. It started hitting me where I couldn't perform my duties at my jobs. And then when I hit 40, I mean, it was just like unbelievable. Full out, you know, I'm in trouble. And,
it's like
not realizing that my problems was related to the Gulf War illness. My father-in-law, who's a Vietnam veteran, he was talking to his VOC, and he was telling him about me and all my problems. And then the VOC is like, well, you know, you need to get him in here. I need to talk to him. And then, you know, I went in there, and then, of course, he filed for my benefits and stuff. So with that being said, you know, there's other veterans out there, I'm sure of it, that have symptoms like this that are not where it's in not letting them be able to work.
Yeah.
So, you know, we definitely got to get away from that date. You know, they need to eliminate it totally. So, you know, that's one thing that the veterans that we got to stand up and fight for.
Right. I'm going to remind everybody we've got about 7 minutes remaining. And if you've called in, hopefully I'll have to check with Doug and see if we can do another call-in next week.
Well, yeah, maybe or the week after. We'll see what we have.
We'll notify everybody again. But we've got about 7 minutes, and I want to mention Altoona. That's Michigan, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got two Michigan people that called in. Hopefully y'all can connect with each other. One of the things I have mentioned in the past is there's been no communication with units, so setting up a unit-specific page on Facebook might help if people are going in and searching and trying to find their buddies. Even if you have one or two people for a long time, you know, eventually people will show up. The other thing is to do state pages. You know, we have a lot of pages out there, but the state page, my thought was that you could get together, meet each other, help each other through this process, share, and as more people get involved, you know, getting together and, you know, meeting up at the VA hospital if you have, you know, appointments at the same time or want to meet up and see how you can help each other, and, you know, form a group in your state and get communication going also with the legislators that have been elected out of your state. Because if you contact them versus me, which I have a national organization I'm involved with, so I can contact them, but when we've done that every year to get funding or whatever, they always tell me, the staffers, you know, the reps go, and we don't hear from our Gulf War vets. And some of that is BS, okay? Mm-hmm. I've learned that through the years. But they do listen to y'all. And to organize groups, and go and meet with them at the home office and say, here we are. This is what we need.
Why don't, you know, we're running on down here, but what I'd like to do here at the end is just go through some of the confirmed diagnoses that we're seeing in approximate percentages.
Before we do that, Doug, let's see if anybody else called in.
Yeah, we got anybody else that's called in.
Doug, can you hear me?
Yeah.
One more thing before you go to another caller. On petitions, whitehouse.gov, I have a petition on there for Obama, President Obama,
right,
to do an investigation. People can go and look at it. It's called Stand Up for Gulf War Veterans. They type that in. They'll see it. You need 25,000 sign-ins before the president, you know, he'll respond to it. So if the listeners out there look at it, they agree with it, you know, please sign the petition.
It's called Stand Up for Gulf War Veterans?
Yeah.
And this is on the White House petition site?
Yes.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's extraordinarily important. A petition, Stand Up for Gulf War Veterans, on the White House petition site. Well, yeah, one of the, and again, let's go quick over some of the diagnoses here in the last couple of minutes before we run over. These are the confirmed diagnoses for what we know as Gulf War illness, which extends into Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom and approximate percentages. Infectious and parasitic diseases, around 15%. We're looking at malignant cancers, over 1%. We're looking at benign cancers, around 6%. We're looking at endocrine, nutritional, metabolic problems, around 30% of the force. We're looking at leukemias, active leukemias, at around 3 to 4% of the force. PTSD and all the other mental things, and again, this is neuropsychologically, that's well over 50%. Neurological systems, sensory problems, we're at 42%. Circulatory, 20%. Respiratory is up around 25%. Digestive is 35%. You know, urinary is 14%. The rashes is over 20%. Muscular skeletal tissue is again up to close to 60%. And undefined symptoms are at over 50%. And injuries and poison is 27%. So this is horrific problems. Again, we're looking at over 300,000 from Desert Storm, well over 1 million for Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. And ladies and gentlemen, we need to continue this discussion. Denise, Ben, thank you. Those that have called in, thank you.